This episode of Screen Talk is presented by Feels Good Man for your consideration for Best Documentary Feature. Can you believe a doc about Pepe the Frog has 3 Critics' Choice nominations, 2 Cinema Eye nominations, and was the second most pirated movie of the year? A New York Times critic's pick, Ben Kenigsberg calls the movie a vertiginous, head-slapping examination of the tangible, unpredictable consequences of making art. Polygon calls it the most urgent and poignant political documentary of the year. As the internet and social media continue to warp consensus reality, Feels Good Man offers a vivid, moving portrait of one artist's fight to take his creation back from the darkness. Feels Good Man is now available on demand or in the Academy screening room. Welcome to Screen Talk, IndieWire's weekly movie podcast. I'm Eric Cohn, the executive editor and chief critic, joined as always by Ann Thompson, our editor at large. And we continue to be in that weird new world of 2021 where talking about movies can seem awfully small relative to things that are going on in the world. How are you hanging in there?
I'm good. I'm 1 foot in front of the other, very busy. That's lucky. I feel happily distracted, you know, in a good way.
I agree. I mean, it's almost
never a dull moment, really. I mean, it's like, okay. Like today, Nomadland is going to go to Hulu. I mean, we were waiting for this. It's not a surprise, but it's still a sign of the new order.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's almost like our work gives us an excuse to be distracted by some of the bigger, crazier things happening in the world, because it's a pretty good excuse. There's a lot of stuff happening in terms of award season in the film industry that seems to indicate we'll have much to do in the year ahead. And that's encouraging, because as much as, you know, with the election, the Capitol riots that happened last week, the inauguration around the corner, it feels like America is going through this reckoning. So is the film industry. And so it's very much, I think, valid to be invested in this work that we do. It doesn't, to me, feel like they're sort of competing in that respect. It's just one piece of this larger pie.
Yeah, we're all adapting to our changing circumstances. There's really conflicting stats in Los Angeles, for example. Parts of California are kind of coming out of this COVID surge a little bit, leveling a little bit. And yet where I live in LA County, it's still pretty dire as far as hospitals go, but it feels like we're getting there. Yeah. And they're loosening up the vaccination protocols like they are everywhere else.
Well, you don't have to worry about going to Sundance this week. That's for sure. Or next week, as it were.
But we did get our little instructional session where we learned.
We're already in Sundance mode.
How lucky we are to be all access holders.
Exactly. And also to be able to experience the festival to the extent that we can, honestly. I mean, the lineup's there. It seems like there's a lot going on. We'll certainly have a strong presence. And so there's going to be plenty to discuss in the next 2 weeks, that I think, tied to films that are there and anything else going on. So that's heartening. We do have a couple other news items to discuss this week, and then we're going to try something a little bit different and answer a few.
Yeah, we went on Twitter questions. And got a lot of good, I have to say, they were good questions.
A lot of good questions. We can keep this going. But first, let's talk about some of the awards news from the past week, because the Gotham Awards happened on Monday, and they really happened in real time. It wasn't just like a live stream that was pre-recorded with all these speeches. There was a live component to it.
Yeah, unfortunately. I'm sorry. It's always been a very bare bones thing. And you get to have the fun part in New York. Usually there's a party. That's the part that's the payoff. But you were part of some virtual table, which made it more fun for you. So that every once in a while, we'd see a little glimpse of you and people like Lisa Tayback on there. But I was not. I was stuck with the Facebook feed, which was, you know, really pretty pathetic, honestly.
Probably kind of clunky would be the word that I would use to describe it. I mean, I watched the live feed. What was fascinating about the Gotham this year is usually what you do, or what I've experienced, is I sit at my table and say hi to people, and then I wander, you know, because you have these long montage moments throughout the ceremony, especially with the special awards and so forth. And it can drag for a lot. It's a big fundraising event.
It's not a show.
No, and there's a green room. There's lots of New York industry people around. Certainly some people who are on the Oscar campaign trail. And usually it's the first big film show of the season. So there's plenty to sort of glean from being in that room. And you couldn't do that this year. But what they did by building this virtual table was they created the conditions so that you could still have kind of a viewing party for the Gothams. And that ended up being kind of fun. I was seated, quote unquote, with a couple other journalists like Mark Harris and Thomas Laughlin, a few others who were on nominating committees like I was. And we had a little chat going. So you kind of had to mute when the ceremony was happening, but it did allow for this kind of interactive component that contributed a sense of exclusivity and participation that makes that kind of experience unique. I also thought that it wasn't the worst show. It was nice to see, obviously, Nomadland winning seemed preordained, and I was on the committee that nominated it, but it seemed like that was probably going to happen, and then it won the audience prize as well. But there were a lot of nice moments throughout
thing about the Gotham Awards is that you have very small groups of people like you, you know, nominating and voting. So it doesn't mean anything, except that it just it's the same thing. If you win a Gotham, it might mean that more people read about it the next day and will look up at someone like Miss Juneteenth. Nicole Beharie, you know, who won Best Actress. I still haven't seen that movie, but maybe I should. And, you know, other people may feel the same way. Someone like Riz Ahmed gave a great speech that popped and got covered and, you know, citing Irfan Khan and how wobbly and uncertain the times are and how we might want to dance together. It was lovely. It was absolutely, the Brits always, you know, they always write better than everyone else. You know, they're more educated or something. They just do. They always give good speeches.
I also appreciated that it was sort of like, you have to embrace the ricketiness of it. Like even Riz Ahmed, yes, he finally found his speech, but he didn't totally realize like that he was sort of all by himself on camera when he won. Like that whole process, it was sort of like, it felt like almost like a dry run for this person.
That's exactly what these awards are for. They're all trying out their personae, their speeches. It's actually a run through. He was better than some of them. I mean, Rada Blank, who's share of the screenplay prize with the guy who wrote, what is it? Four?
14.
Miss Juneteenth, 14.
The numbers are on the place.
Yeah. So she was great. She did a whole sort of I'm so surprised routine, which was entertaining. I love that movie. You know, the word on the street on that movie is very strong. It could be a surprise screenplay contender.
Well, certainly Rada Blank was one of, you know, flashback to a year ago, one of the major breakouts of the Sundance Film Festival.
Exactly.
Here. And that was a movie that really benefited from the physical Sundance environment, from the way it was this crowd pleaser in the room to just having somebody like that kind of work the scene. And I think that momentum has sustained that movie on some level. And of course, now it's on Netflix, which gives it incredible visibility for a movie like that.
It has good word of mouth. And so you get the sense that more and more people are watching it. Just to pull away from the Gothams for a second. It's interesting. I mean, just as Nomadland is about to go to Hulu, it's interesting that you get something like The King of Staten Island on, which is a Universal movie from Judd Apatow that came out at the beginning of the pandemic, that is now on HBO Max for whatever reason. Universal seems to be sending its films there instead of Peacock. And lots of people watched The King of Staten Island, including me. And it's really good. It is very hard to do a comedy like that, to write it and to have every bit of casting be so perfect. I was very taken with it.
I enjoyed it to the extent that one can enjoy that movie and not get exhausted by questions of how much movie there is there. I mean, every Apatow movie seems to push the boundaries of how long an endearing comedy about a man-child trying to put his life together should be. But I did appreciate with 40-year-old Virgin that it was an explicit callback to 40-year-old Virgin and also has the same kind of long running time that is sort of a Judd Apatow movie tends to have with a comedy. You know, this idea of like, we're going to give you so much comedy that, you know, you're definitely going to feel like you got more than enough. And I do feel like with King of Staten Island, it does push those boundaries a bit, but he's very good in it. Pete Davidson?
For me, it was more about Bill Burr and Belle Powley and Marissa Tomei. I mean, I was taken with all of them. It wasn't just about Pete Davidson. He wasn't carrying it for me.
I would have liked a little bit more from those characters, in particular Marissa Tomei, who unfortunately often does seem saddled with these, especially on the studio front, with these supporting roles that could be a little bit meatier. But I mean, ultimately that was designed as a showcase for Pete Davidson. And I wonder if under more conventional circumstances, whether 2020 would have been a real turning point for him as a movie actor, had that movie, you know, ended up having a big kind of commercial theatrical life, which obviously it didn't have.
Right.
So it's an interesting question. Well, let's move on, because the other thing we should talk about is some Oscar news, because we still don't know everything that's going to sort of impact the buzz with award season, because qualification windows have not closed yet. But we did get some Oscar winners with the special Oscar prizes that are being given out, two for the first time, honorary Oscars. So what did you make of this, the fact that we've got two special Oscars going out this year as opposed to one?
Okay, so usually we have the Governor's Awards, and the Governor's Awards is something where they broke away some of these honorary Oscars and took them off of the big Oscar cast. You know, back in the day, you'd have someone like Stanley Donen doing a tap dance while he accepted his honorary Oscar, you know, that kind of thing. So now that it, and what they've turned it into is this big party, and all the Oscar contenders show up in one place at one time. Well, guess what? That's not happening this year. So they're just taking two of them and putting them into the Oscar show. And they're giving Tyler Perry the Jean Hirschhold Humanitarian Award, which is, he's really worked hard to help people who are homeless, to help to build a studio, to employ people, to help people who are affected by the pandemic. And so he has a lot of charity stuff going on, and that makes perfect sense. And then the other one is going to the Motion Picture Fund, which has just stepped up beyond the call to support a lot of people who are in need during this pandemic year. And they've never given one to an organization before. And it's very much the Academy's own universe. And it makes sense that they would make an exception this year and do that.
I think the Tyler Perry one is interesting too, because Tyler Perry is not gunning for to win any Oscars anytime soon. I mean, that's sort of, I remember when For Colored Girls
came out. It's unlikely. That's not true. He could do a supporting role in some movie where he knocks it out of the park.
Yeah, there was some talk about that around Veep. But I remember when For Colored Girls came out, there was like a brief moment where people were like, could this be his moment? And then you saw the movie and you're like, no, he doesn't make those kinds of movies. But what's fascinating about Tyler Perry is that he seems to have sort of made peace with that question and sort of gone all in terms of using the scale of his brand and the incredible amount of money that he's in. He's a billionaire now, to basically create a side of the industry that was just not there before. I mean, his presence in Atlanta is staggering. You know, he hosted a presidential debate there. He flew into Atlanta to vote, I noticed, because he didn't have absentee ballot in time. But he has, I think, found a way to win people over, even if the work itself is not always for them. And I think that's commendable in its own right, because he's still contributing to...
Let's say that he exemplifies someone who gives back.
Yeah, exactly. I think all of this also feeds into this broader question we've looked at over the last few months, which is, what role the Oscars plays from sort of almost like a charity standpoint. I mean, we knew, you know, by last summer even, that whenever the Oscars would happen, the industry would be in this terrible place and struggling to recover on every level. And, people are fortunate to still be working, but we are still very much in a pandemic, and it's going to take a long time to undo a lot of the damage that's been done. So I do wonder, you know, is this the first step in seeing how the Oscars are stepping up this year to sort of be that kind of an event, to be the night of...
Well, they have no choice. I think they're going to have to respond. First of all those questions about whether it's going to be live or not. I mean, this is one of the questions that people are asking us on Twitter today. You know, what are we expecting to see, you know, at the Oscars this year? And I'm seeing definitely not a live event. I'm seeing, and I don't think they're going to move it. I don't think they're going to change anything. They're stuck. They're in. It's all going forward as it is. And there is an entire ecosystem that has been proceeding forward. There are going to be SAG Awards. There are going to be Golden Globe Awards. There's going to be Critics' Choice Awards. All these things are, and the guilds, the usual running tally is going to take place. But the event itself, that is going to be interesting. Is there a host? Is there going to be some kind of understanding of a fundraiser?
Yeah.
Some kind of sense of giving back to help the theaters that are, I mean, because that's what the Oscars are. They're an advertisement for movie going. So they're going to be bound to address that. And my guess is, just as Tom Hanks is stepping up to help with the inauguration festivities, I think there will be major movie stars all over our industry more than happy to step up for the Oscars this year. First of all, they've been sitting at home doing nothing for a while anyway, right. And they might as well. This is, and maybe they don't have to show up to the red carpet and do anything live. They can do it from their homes.
Well, it sure does make that usual question about the Oscars, how do you get more people to tune into them, seem kind of small, but that's still part of the question, right? They've got that contract with ABC, so they're going to want people to tune into this thing. And that's
the titles are not friendly in that way.
Right. Right.
On the one hand, you've seen them they've been widely streamed. But on the other, what is the awareness and what is the pull for titles? I mean, Soul is a big title, maybe, or Wonder Woman. I don't know.
Chicago 7, maybe on some level, maybe Borat on some level, but not.
Maybe Tenet on some level, but they're not the big Best Picture contenders, you know?
Right. So then
Chicago 7 is probably the most watched Oscar contender in the running.
Right. Unfortunately, Mank doesn't seem to have risen to that level, though there's still time because it's on the same service. So who knows? But
people are doing a great job of promoting everything. And of course, on Friday, they introduced Malcolm and Marie, which is their latest one that they picked up that was made during the pandemic by Sam Levinson of Euphoria fame. And John David Robertson, listen to me, Washington, otherwise known as JD, and Zendaya, otherwise known as Z, are the stars of this. And it's a really fun Cassavetes-inspired black and white two-hander. Did you get to watch?
I did get a chance to see it. And I think it's going to be fascinating to see, of all the Netflix films, whether or not this one crosses over, because those are very charismatic actors and it's a gorgeous movie, but its subject matter is it feels like it was made in the IndieWire universe, and not only because our site gets a shout out in it, because it's got this this self-absorbed filmmaker type who wants to hit it big, and he's obsessed with a review he's waiting on, and I just think it's fascinating to think about that being something that a mass audience could tune into. But certainly those performances are what drive that thing along, and they really go at it, you know, the whole way through.
Do well on Netflix. I think those performers are a good lure, I don't know. I think it's actually a relationship movie as well as a showbiz tale. And showbiz tales do well. They do well with the Academy. So we'll see. We'll see how they do. The critics, what you're sort of saying too, is how are the critics going to respond to it? Because the initial response was pretty good, but often the more sober light of day response can be a little tougher.
You got to pay attention to the tweets versus the reviews, because the timeline does not put those two things in the same place. And I think it might be a little bit more mixed, but I do think also it's a movie that people will be kind to, especially because it's taking some swings at being cinematic. And you know, it's a contrast to, say, a Chicago 7 that's a little bit more, you know, it's a little more square, a little more familiar, and this is something a little risky.
It's very hip. You're right about that. The other, I loved it. I really thought it was a good, they did a good job. The person who breaks out of it, as good as Washington is Zendaya, and I think she could challenge Viola for Best Actress, and that's going to be interesting. Netflix has created their own competition there.
It was in
Ma Rainey's Black Bottom.
Happening. I mean, Ma Rainey had a great moment at the Gothams too, obviously, because they gave Viola Davis Special Award and this really emotional posthumous award to Chadwick Boseman, delivered by a speech from his widow, which was very emotional. And it seems like those two are still very much.
They're very much at the front of the pack in both of their categories. Ma Rainey's doing very well.
Indeed, indeed. So let's take some questions, because I think one of the things that I've always appreciated about this podcast, I know you do too, is knowing that there are people out there who are kind of following the kind of, you know, arbitrary nature of our conversations and the ever-changing environment that we work in, and they have their own things that they want to know. And we kind of assume that we know what the conversations are worth having each week. So it's nice to hear from people and see what they want to know. So why don't we go through a few of these? I'm going to start with this question from Cordia Covens. I don't know if that's this person's real name or if I butchered it or whatever, but that's Twitter for you. So this question is, how will the current situation with impeachment and Biden taking over, thank God, influence the coming Oscar season, and what movies might benefit from this? Is it Judas and the Black Messiah, Chicago 7, or titles that we haven't heard about yet? I think this is a great question because, I mean, by the time we get into Sundance next week, Biden will have been inaugurated. There will be this, hopefully, a sense of, you know, new possibility. We're coming out of election season as opposed to going into one. So I wonder if that is an important consideration. Certainly, it seems like with Sacha Baron Cohen, who has been at the forefront of trying to raise the standards of social media platforms, and now, you know, Trump has been booted from all of them. It seems to play into his favor both for Chicago 7 and for Borat for different kinds of reasons. Judas and the Black Messiah, we'll see. Certainly, that's a topical movie dealing with the Black Panthers and Fred Hampton and so forth, but that's going to come.
I think that will mainly be a vehicle for Daniel Kaluuya, and a good one, a strong one. He's very, very good in the movie, and I think he could sneak into that supporting actor category. Part of what's going on in that category is that, as good as The Trial of the Chicago 7 and One Night in Miami are, you have a lot of people vying from the same movie for the same slots. And I will predict that it will be Sacha Baron Cohen that will emerge with a nomination, along with Leslie Odom Jr. And there could be room for someone coming in from another movie. And that could knock out some of the other players from those two films.
Right.
And but what I was going to say is that the Academy is always liberal leaning, always very subject to the zeitgeist, and the zeitgeist is very prevailing. So these serious political movies, I mean, the thing that I want to say about The Trial of the Chicago 7 that is going, which is to its advantage, I did this interview with Aaron Sorkin where I said, I just went on about how much fun the movie was. And I think he was slightly put off by that, you know, is like, it's not just fun, you know, kind of thing. He handled it.
Well, he should know better, because most Sorkin movies are trying to be fun. That's kind of the key.
He knows how to do that. And that is a hard thing to do. So does so does Sacha Baron Cohen.
My guy.
Your guy. Yeah. So I would suggest to you that the Academy knows this too, that they know the difference between an entertaining political smart movie and a dull and earnest one.
Yeah, and we've been down.
And that's the problem.
I mean, the last 4 years.
One of the others.
The last 4 years, we've seen this happen. We remember when The Post was a late admittance to award season, and
that got punished for being rushed. That got punished for not being fully.
It got less nominations. Certainly, it was in the conversation, but it was something where it almost felt like, well, did you need to get that out there right when you got it out there? It's an old story, and the whole fake news complaint that was coming out of the terrible administration we've been dealing with was not going anywhere either. So it is an interesting question. Sometimes it goes too far. But I remember when Spike Lee won for Black Klansman, you know, his call to arms about the midterm elections. Well, that was just a great moment, because he had spent all season railing against Agent Orange. And that really played into his favor, to have him have a reason to keep doing that.
So Spike Lee tonight is going to be getting the AFI award, and however that's going to play in the universe of the Academy, we'll see. But I think that Defy Bloods is not out of the picture. It is a movie of scale and scope and seriousness that is also timely. So I think that all of the films that are both entertaining and timely will resonate and will have an advantage.
So we got a question from Pedro Paulo Araujo. asking about foreign language submissions and predictions. And I bring that one up because we got a few different variations of this question.
Yeah, people are curious about that category.
People really want to know that.
Because it's starting to catch up.
There's so many. I mean, you can look at Wikipedia at all the submissions. Some of these films we've been talking about all year long, even since 2019, and some of them nobody's heard of before. So
you can also look at my Oscar predictions page for the best international feature. Might help. You don't have to go to Wikipedia.
That might help whittle it down a bit too, because your list gives people.
I actually pick what the top 10 will be, but I haven't seen all of them, you know, enough yet. There's a lot, and I know you and I have both been sampling them, and there's way, way, way more to come. Last night, I watched a movie whose title I'm going to have. You go first while I look up the title of this movie so that I don't butcher it. You go ahead.
Well, I wanted to give a shout out to a movie that I saw out of the Locarno Film Festival in 2019, which is the Portuguese submission, Vitalina Varela. It's Pedro Costa's new film. Pedro Costa, obviously one of the great Portuguese filmmakers working, and also a very consistent kind of vision of the despair and poverty experienced by this immigrant community called Fontanes. And through his films over the years, he dug deeper into that world, and he found this woman in his last film, Horse Money, named Vitalina Varela, who had left Portugal, came back when her husband died, and sort of confronts her past life with him and how it fell apart. And he makes this amazing kind of doc narrative hybrid out of her confronting that community haunted by the past. It's this beautiful tone poem. Every shot is like a great painting. And I really hope that however it goes down with the Academy sort of going through its options here in terms of what it's submitting for the shortlist, that they give this movie a shot, because if it gets on there, I think more people will give it time. And it's a movie that benefits from a big screen. It's not a movie that would necessarily get noticed otherwise. So what's
going on is that people like you and people like me are checking in with others, and we're all giving each other tips on what are some of the good ones. The one I saw last night was Preparations to Be Together for an Unknown Period of Time, which is the Hungarian entry, which I really liked. I highly recommend it. And whether or not that's going to be one of the big contenders. I know that The Mole Agent, which you love, has been playing very well. People have been talking about that. Great. And
that's the
Apple is very good. That's the Greek entry. One of the new weird Greek. So I'm shocked and surprised, Eric, that you haven't seen that one already.
Well, that was at Toronto.
A fan of Yorgos Lanthimos.
Oh yeah, no, I heard great stuff about it. And it was in Toronto and I couldn't get around. So this is one reason why the Oscars are actually really valuable, in the sense that it forces you to fill in certain gaps so you can keep up with the conversation. So we'll see how it goes with that one.
I also recommend Eterno, which is one of the documentaries that's been entered along with Collective.
Yeah, Collective, I would say, is another one where it's like that could be a Honeyland type of situation nominated.
Right.
Categories. So
it's interesting because Honeyland was really the first documentary to be submitted and entered finally as a nominee for Best International Feature. Now a lot of them are doing it. Another round is picking up steam. Everybody is enjoying that. The Thomas Vinterberg starring Mads Mikkelsen.
That's just
as an alcoholic dancer. No, I love that.
He's only a dancer at the very end, but it's sort of one of the higher profile ones, I would say. It seems like
that's the most. And then Charlatan, the Agnieszka Holland, is very good, which we saw in Berlin. And Hope is a very good movie from Norway with Stellan Skarsgård. It's a family drama based on a true story from the director herself. And I really, really liked it. And you're a fan, as I am, of the Mexican film, I'm No Longer Here, from Fernando Frias.
Because Guillermo del Toro behind it. So and obviously.
And Alfonso Cuarón.
Yeah. So yeah. That one's got some traction.
Anything else?
Well, I'm sure we're forgetting something, but that's sort of what's amazing is that there's such a wide array of possibilities right now. And ultimately, somebody's going to get snubbed when that shortlist gets out there. Probably one of the films that you just mentioned, in fact. I mean, there's not enough.
Well, part of what's going on, too, is that the individual members are not only looking at whatever they feel like looking at, but they've got about 12 movies that they're assigned to see, that they have to see. the documentary branch has a similar system.
Yeah.
Yeah. Otherwise, a lot of the obscure titles that no one wants to see or that everyone has been told are boring won't get watched. So
another question here. We have one from Mike and Oscar, at MM and Oscar, asking about an Oscar ceiling / upside for potential late breaking contenders, Malcolm and Marie, Judas and the Black Messiah. We've talked about these films a bit already, but I think it's a interesting question because
what does he mean ceiling?
Let's say that you have only 3-4 weeks to be an Oscar contender, as opposed to say Nomadland, which has been out there since September. At least,
but it hasn't been widely seen because it hasn't been available.
But it is worth looking at this because even so, there's been visibility. People have been talking about Nomadland. If you're a Judas and
because the Black of the Messiah, festivals, yeah,
you're a Judas and Black Messiah. Really only has a couple weeks to establish itself.
On HBO Max, though. It'll be on HBO Max, so along with The Little Things, the Denzel Washington movie.
That does figure into this on some levels, that something that compensates for the lack of time that some of these films have to get noticed is that they might be more visible than usual because they're all over the place.
Okay, so the there's tricky factors there. Like Clint Eastwood has always been famous for bringing his movies in at the last minute, and then they haven't necessarily been widely seen by the public sometimes when they open at the end of December, the beginning of January, and then go into the Oscars. They but usually you have to have a movie star. You have to have some established title in order for that to become a must-see instantly by everyone in order to make it an Academy contender. So the ones to worry about, I would say Judas and the Black Messiah would be iffier in the sense that Daniel Kaluuya isn't the same level of name that a Denzel Washington is. People are going to look at the Denzel Washington movie because he's Denzel Washington. But they and Malcolm and Marie, it has the Netflix buzz around it. I would say the one to worry, something like Cherry coming from Apple with the Russo brothers and Tom Holland. It's a question also of how the critics respond because none of these have had festival launches.
Right. You still have to stuff things into a shorter period of time, but then they could also make a lot of noise because the latecomers for the most part have a lot of resources behind them. So
and so they also missed the critics awards, which happened already, and except they'll be eligible for the later ones, but it's still going to be harder to get into SAG, which is voting now.
Yeah.
To get into Golden Globes. It's even Malcolm and Marie is going to have a tough time registering with those. Apologies.
A busy time. Well, let's squeeze in one last question to end on, because I think this is kind of a fun role-playing one. And it comes from @BoomerKnight, who's asking, if you ran the Oscars, how would you produce a socially distant yet entertaining show? I'll tell you what I would do. I always like when the Oscars brings quote unquote real people in or does some sort of stunt thing that goes beyond the constraints of where the event takes place. Like when they ordered a pizza and the pizza man came out on stage, or when the camera followed the host into a movie theater across the street or whatever. Now you got people at home. I would love to see like hosts randomly calling somebody who's watching the Oscars and like somebody who's watching the show suddenly realizing that they're on TV for millions of people. Like that kind of holistic approach to making
it. As long as it doesn't play like the Gothams.
No, I'm telling you, you could do it like the Gothams, but much better. That's basically what I'm pitching. No, and I think
sure,
making
I'm
it
sure
democratic.
They'll figure out how to do it in a smooth and serene kind of way, but it'll be interesting to see how they'll have to have the Emmys did it okay. Loved it when those Canadians for Schitt's Creek were having a big party.
Yeah, they also
in Canada.
Creek, those people knew they were going to win 10,000 awards, so they could like justify throwing a giant socially distant party. I don't think it was bankrolled by the Emmys, but we'll see if anybody pulls that off this year. So next week, I guess we'll be looking ahead to Sundance. We can trade some notes from the inauguration, which God willing, will bring the country in the right direction. And we can give some people.
So we have a couple of questions about Sundance. So I think we should definitely, we'll address those next week.
Yes.
We'll have a better idea of what the hot titles might be.
Hold on to your tweets, folks. All right, I'll see you then, Anne. Bye.